Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. I'll ask you one last question about sexuality, just because it's so important. I guess there's this idealistic hope within traditional Orthodox believing Mormonism that homosexuality is somehow a choice, that somehow it's a transgression, that it's just evil, pure and simple, and that if you find the right therapist or if you pray and read your scriptures or, you know, think the right thoughts or, you know, do athletics and spend more time with the opposite sex, that you can ungay yourself in some way. Have you had any experience with that at all to either validate that hope or to invalidate that hope or expectation?
Well, the becoming ungay, no. I have not seen any research to validate that. I've not seen any studies to validate that. I've never met anybody that would validate that experience. Now, I do know of people that choose to stay in a heterosexual relationship, even though they are homosexual. And there are different ways people do that, some with more success than others. But the idea that somehow we can change our arousal template is usually not, at least right now, not well-founded in research.
So whatever it is that turns you on or gets you sexually aroused is just something that you didn't choose or that's kind of beyond your ability to control?
Yeah, I think arousal is very difficult to control. Now, what we do with that arousal is obviously where the gospel comes in, right? Because, I mean, that's like teenage kids who want to have sex. So they're getting aroused, which is normal, but we want to help them maybe control that or know what to do with that arousal once it comes up. Now, so that has nothing to do with homosexuality. But, I mean, I think that, yeah, this idea that somehow, and I think there has been quite a bit of studies done, especially back in the 70s and 80s on like electroconvulsive therapy or, you know, trying to rewire the brain or, you know, because there's a lot of people who are homosexual who are desperate not to be homosexual,
right?
Because they want to fit into their cultural norm and they want to have a family and they want to kind of follow the normal course that they see most of their culture following. So they will submit themselves to all kinds of therapies or trials or exploratory types of things to try to do that. And I've never seen anything that has been, you know, like that has converted a homosexual to a heterosexual. Now there's also, we have to discuss that there's a range in sexuality, you know, so there are people who consider themselves bisexual who can actually be turned on or aroused with both genders. So maybe in those cases, that's easier because then they just decide, well, I'm just going to choose to behave in my heterosexual lifestyle because there's still some arousal for the opposite gender.
Right.
But there are people who fall, I guess, more on the extremes of the continuum where they really do not have any arousal for the opposite gender. So
what are the options through therapy for someone who's just 100% attracted to the same sex or same gender? Like, what are the different options for an LDS church member in that situation? And what are the prospects or the success rates in your experience for the different possibilities?
Well, I guess it's how we define success. You know, if success means that they're now going to be
mental health
heterosexual, then no, that's not going to be successful. I think, you know, the people that I've worked with in this situation are probably the most heartbreaking cases I've had because there aren't a lot of tools that I have to offer them. I mean, there's the tool of being celibate the rest of their lives. That's pretty rugged. there's the tool of trying to enter a heterosexual relationship, or they're already in a heterosexual relationship. And now what? You know, what do we do now? Or how do we, you know, have a relationship where this shouldn't matter to us, this aspect of our relation, or the physical intimacy shouldn't be important to us. That's very difficult. Mm-hmm. And then there's the route of, well, accept who you are and, you know, go join the homosexual lifestyle, which goes against our values as a religion. So it's very, I don't have any like great answers. We talk, we discuss all the options, we discuss what they want, we discuss, you know, we, again, I normalize, I educate, I talk about it not being necessarily a choice of arousal, but a choice of behavior and, you know, what can they do with that? And, so, you know, I think all those things are helpful and help them to try to, you know, make a path that's viable for them. And in the church, I've seen all kinds of things. People leave the church, people stay married in their temple marriages, people are celibate, people are doing all kinds of different things. People divorce their temple marriage spouse and leave their family and join the homosexual lifestyle. People even are staying in their marriages and having separate sexual lives. I mean, that's even happening within the Mormon faith.
Mm-hmm. For I've heard often for those who decide just to not be sexual at all, or when they discuss that pathway, they say, hey, you know, some people never get married. They just never find the one that they love. Or, you know, some people have their spouse die and they don't find someone to get married. And that's just part of life. If you live the gospel, you know, so some of us just don't get that intimacy, and that's just part of the package. Is there anything more to the story that we should know about that option other than just...
I think we say those things, and what happens is we're just shutting down conversation. I think that people go, uh-huh, okay. And some people do that. And then other people just go back into their stories of shame and secrecy, which is what I see more often. So in other words, you know, if that's the expectation, if they go into their bishop and that's what the bishop tells them, what can they say to that? Right. Oh, you're wrong. So they just nod their head and they go, yeah, you're right. And they go on and they either continue behaviors in secrecy and shame, or they leave the church, or they stay celibate.
Right.
There's not a lot of great options here.
Right. And have you seen people try to remain celibate for an extended period of time, and what makes that so hard? Is it that bad?
Well, I think if you are a normal, sexual, healthy individual, it's difficult. Yes. I think that is hard to completely ignore all those urges that you have for an unlimited amount of time.
Right.
It's one thing when we're single adults, right? Trying to hold on for a few years or, but if you've got the rest of your life to look at in that state, most of the homosexual men that have spoken with me will actually say, I'm not willing to just be celibate the rest of my life. That's not a feasible option for me. So, you know, what do I tell them? I have to respect that.
Right.
And, you know, I think also as we grow older, we do tend, all of us have sexual drives that go through cycles. You know, men tend to hit their sexual peak earlier than women. And then as we age, sexual drive does decrease. It doesn't go away. And there's many elderly people who are having really great sex lives, maybe not as often, maybe not with the same frequency, but usually quite intimate. That's a whole nother thing we never talk about, is the elderly having sex.
Right.
But I think that, you know, people who choose to be celibate older is probably a little bit easier, but I wouldn't say it's easy. And and then there's people who truly are just asexual, who, and that's not necessarily healthy, but if they're okay with it and they don't care and they're just going to plan on being celibate the rest of their lives, then, you know, that's an option for them, but that's not necessarily considered healthy.
Right. So you can't just look at everyone as being monolithic in that regard. There's sexual orientation and then there's sex drive. And the combination of those two can put people all over the spectrum in terms of what's possible
Exactly.
and what's healthy and what's feasible and what's just totally unreasonable to expect.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And and a lot of people will say, well, what about, like when your spouse dies or when your spouse, is what, a paraplegic or, but those, it's difficult to say, you should look at somebody else's completely different situation and apply it to yourself.
Right.
I mean, when people have to deal with those things, they're very difficult in their own right, and people struggle immensely in those issues as well. So I think it kind of is minimizing to say, well, there's plenty of people who aren't able to have sex, so you should just be fine with that.
Right.
When it's such a part of our human development, it's such a part of how our Heavenly Father made us. It's a
Right.
huge part of us.
Yeah. Yeah, it's huge. So let's turn a bit and talk about something that is brought up quite a bit in the LDS context, and that's depression. There's this depression, there's this impression that, Utah leads the nation in, depression. That's us, some people like to say that, or that we lead the nation in the use of psychotropic, medication. And there's also the stigma that the Mormon lifestyle is particularly hard on women, that raising all these children and being confined to the home and all the demands that the church puts on women leads to a very high depression rates for women within the church. Why don't we back up and just talk a little bit about your experiences about depression with Mormon people, men and women?
Well, I think depression is a very common disorder, I guess. I guess it's a difficult word. It's kind of like the addiction word because we use it in both clinical ways and we use it very much in non-clinical ways.
Right.
So, for instance, it's very common to hear people say, "Oh, I feel depressed today," or "I'm feeling depressed," or "I'm in a depressed funk," or and depression in that sense is part of normal life. We all have our ups and downs, we have our mood swings. There's days that are harder than others. So that's kind of normal. I think where depression really has a becomes very problematic is when it becomes life, it really alters your life. You find yourself not being able to get up, you find yourself, losing weight or gaining weight or not sleeping well, feelings of hopelessness, feelings of worthlessness, to the point of having suicidal thoughts even. Many people have suicidal thoughts without ever trying to commit suicide because they don't believe in it, but they still have those thoughts kind of as an escape. If I could only just die, I'd be better off. My family would be better off. Everybody would be better off. So those are suicidal thoughts, even without a plan attached to them, which are greatly disabilitating for people,
Right.
disabling for people to have those kinds of thoughts on a continual basis. So yeah, and part of that can be with attached to, high expectations. You have high expectations of yourself due to your religion or whatever, and you never can meet those expectations. So you're always feeling badly about yourself. You're comparing yourself to others who seem to be able to meet those expectations and you can't. So that's maybe where it comes in with Mormon women. Although I like to think of the fact that, it seems like a bad rap that the Mormons in Utah are getting, help for their depression, but why can't that be a good thing? Maybe they're being self-sufficient and going in when they need help.
Right.
So maybe that's because that is part of our culture too, is to, when there's a problem, fix it. So maybe we're just ahead of the game on that. But of course, nobody's going to paint it that way. They're going to paint it as a negative. I think that men have similar issues with depression than women, but they tend to deal with them differently. So they're not going to talk about it as often. So even though the numbers show that women are more depressed than men, I'm not sure how true that is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great book called, let's see if I can see it here. It's called New Light on Depression. It's by David Biebel, B-I-E-B-E-L, and some other guy. Anyway, it's written from a Christian perspective, not an LDS perspective, but they do a great job of explaining all the different types of depression, you know, the situational depressions, you know, like something has really happened bad in your life, and so you're depressed about it. The maybe more moral depression, right? Like you're not doing everything right, so now you're depressed. And that can be true or untrue. Like you could be really making some mistakes, or you could just be perceiving that you're not a worthy member. And either way, that's going to lead to depression.
Mm-hmm.
There's biological depression, which we don't talk about a lot. And that's something that usually runs in families and many times will affect people, even though they have pretty good lives, they feel pretty good about themselves, and yet they're having huge symptoms of depression. So that has more of a biological nature to it. And right. there's a lot of, they're coming out with a lot of new research on this. Like if you look at a brain that's depressed and a brain that isn't, I mean, you can see a pretty dramatic difference.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes back to what we first talked about, which you asked me, you know, well, why are people hesitant to get mental health help? Well, when you break your arm, you go to the doctor, they have this x-ray, you can see a very clear cut. And so you're like, yeah, I believe you. You know, we have to do something about this. Just until recently, we really haven't been able to do that in the mental health field. I mean, the brain is hugely complex.
Kind of a black box.
Yeah, it's just how do you measure it? You know, how do you? But they are starting with, you know, a lot of more of these MRI or CAT scans or things to be able to look at brain differences. And one of the things that they're finding is the depressed brain is actually smaller, and it's not firing these synapses as often as they should be. Mm-hmm. So when people are like, oh, you know, antidepressants are a joke or whatever, they're really not. They really can make a huge difference for many people.
Mm.
So, and in fact, the number one treatment for depression is a combination of talk therapy and antidepressants.
Mm-hmm.
That's been researched many, many times, and they always come out with the same result.
Right.
If you'd only do the antidepressants, they can help, but you're still having to struggle with all the things in your life that the antidepressants don't really help you with.
Right.
And if you only do talk therapy, you can start trying to focus on the things in your life, but your synapses aren't moving any faster. So the combination of those two are what makes people much, much more quickly be able to kind of rehabilitate from depression.
So for you, there shouldn't be a blanket stigma against medication, psychological medication.
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
You see it as sometimes critical and often very useful.
Life-altering and many times life-saving.
What about overprescribed at times?
Yeah, there's a worry about that. And, you know, if you just go in and have a few symptoms and the first thing they do is give you medicine, or we want that kind of that immediate result, the magic pill, right? Whether it's diet or depression or whatever it is, we want to just be able to take something and be magically better. And that's why I say it takes, you know, the two things in conjunction, because it's not just as easy usually as just taking a pill. And antidepressants in general are complicated because they take 2 to 3 weeks to work.
Right.
And doses can be different, and there's several different kinds. And so a lot of people will try a minimum dose for 3 weeks of one medication, decide it doesn't work, decide medicines are a hoax, and never try it again. And what's hard about, you know, antidepressants is that you need to be more creative with your physician, or if you've got really severe depression, you really should be seeing a psychiatrist.
Right. Right.
Because they can even do combinations of meds, and people can have a very different life.
Sure, you know, sure.
It's just like people who have diabetes and need insulin or So yeah, I'm actually more worried about people being under medicated than over medicated,
Right.
because I just don't think people are going in to get help to begin with.
Right.
So they're not even getting the chance to be on medication.
Do you find that psychiatrists are sufficiently referring people to talk therapists, or do you find that psychiatrists are just encouraging people to just rely on the medication and that's it?
Most of the psychiatrists I know are encouraging talk therapy as well. I think again, the research is shown by all of us. Just like I know that the medicine helps, but I'm a therapist, I'm not a doctor. So I'm referring my clients to that as well. So I would think that it's just part of their ethical responsibility to know what is the treatment that is best applicable in each situation, and therapy for depression is part of that.
Right.
So most of the therapists or psychiatrists that I know are referring out.
That's great. That's
You know,
great.
the art of psychiatry has changed dramatically. I mean, they used to be the ones that would spend an hour with people, and some psychiatrists still do, but most psychiatrists now, you get them for 15 minutes because of all the health insurance and all those things that have happened. So
Right.
they don't have the time to do the therapy with you,
Yeah.
the therapy piece.
That's right. Yeah, it's not cost efficient, not cost
Right.
effective. But is there a pathway that you've seen where medication was, for some people, medication was necessary and even critical in the beginning, but through talk therapy and maybe some other adjustments, people were able to not always require the medication, in the medium to long term? Or is it
Yeah,
sort of
there's.
what once you're on it, you're going to be on it for the rest of your life kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely not. People who tend to have the biological reasons for depression tend to be ones that will probably need it the rest of their lives, kind of like a diabetic, like juvenile diabetes versus diabetes when you're older, right? The type 1 and type 2. The type 2 you can treat with diet and eventually maybe you can get off the insulin. But the type 1 is pretty genetic and part of your body, so you need the insulin the rest of your life. So depression is kind of like that as well. Like people who have situational depression or even moral depression or kind of more those things that have to do with the way they think about themselves or the way something that's happened in their life usually will not need medicine the rest of their life.
Right.
But people who have a biological foundation for it may truly need it. And I always say, just you can try to wean yourself off and see how you feel. And if you feel really a lot worse, then that's kind of a sign that you probably need that chemical in your body because your body's lacking that chemical.
Yeah. Is there, so we touched on this briefly, but is there any credibility to those who would say Mormonism is bad for women or too hard on women or, Mormonism causes depression in women? In your anecdotal experience, is that overreaching or is there a little bit of truth to that or no truth at all or a ton of truth or what are your thoughts on that?
Maybe this is where the gospel doctrine of opposition in all things comes into play for me. Maybe this is my bias, but I think that there's good and bad in everything for anybody. So can some aspects of our Mormon culture be negative? Absolutely. And I see that kind of stuff all the time. But there's huge parts of our Mormon culture that are extremely positive for people and that help them have purpose in life and help them, have goals and kind of an eternal perspective and, give meaning to their lives and give them structure and routine, which all of us need at some level. Help them think about things that are not just, the here and now, but what are we really working towards? Common goals, in couples. So, I mean, it's just how people choose to approach their religion, I think. And if you want to approach it in a negative way and get overly stressed and be anxious that you're not the perfect Mormon wife and that you haven't baked bread in the last week and you haven't done your 50 names or, I mean, we can go down the list. Yeah, that can be not a healthy approach. As, there's a time and a season for everything. And I love the scripture that says, you don't need to run faster than you have strength. And we don't always remember that. But, I'm not so sure that it's the Mormon culture that does that completely. I think it's part of it, but it's also our individual personalities. I mean, some of us are more anxious, and you know, even if they weren't Mormons, they might still be dealing with similar anxieties. So again, there's a lot of different components. I'm not a believer of a one component type thing causing everything.
Right.
There's a lot of different pieces to everybody's puzzle.
Yeah, that systems thing coming back together again, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, really, there's genetics, there's hormones and chemicals, there's upbringing.
Yeah.
If you believe in the church, there's some type of spiritual or, you know, pre sort of intelligence that you bring with you that's going to be a factor. There's the family system that you're put in. There's the ward, and every ward is going to be different. There's your family that you were brought up in. There's your marital relationship. There's your relationship with your children, if you have them, and whatever else comes along. It's just so many factors. It's hard to really ever feel comfortable nailing it to anything, right?
Yeah, I mean, your personality traits and your temperament, and
right.
I mean, for any of us who have more than one child, I mean, you can see how they're just each completely different, you know, and even growing up in the same home with the same DNA blowing, you know, flowing through them.
Right.
They're extremely different and will perceive you as parents differently. You know, if anybody's had a chat with their siblings lately, and I remember having several powwows with my siblings where we would all just kind of be like, what family did you grow up in?
Right.
So we just perceive things differently. Again, it goes back to those love languages and how we're wired in so many different ways.
Right. Yeah, and I guess a way to summarize this this little segment is you know you've been spending several years now, particularly with LDS clients,
correct?
And in spite of the fact that you're dealing daily with mental illness in the context of the Mormon church or the LDS church or the Mormon culture, you have not, is it fair to say you have not come away with the feeling that the church is just overall damaging to people's mental health and destructive?
No.
Even though you deal in it every day.
Right. No, I would say that, first of all, I want to classify a few things. The gospel is everything that will direct us towards mental health. If you just take the basic teachings of Jesus Christ in the New Testament and all the basic things that he talked about, love and compassion and communication and service, those are the things that will, those are the basics, right, of the gospel. And, right. and quite frankly, the basics of many world religions. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that grow us closer, not only to our God, but to each other. And,
right.
you know, and help us have perspective on ourselves. Now, then you break it down. You have the basic gospel. Then you have church doctrine, which is, you know, now man has stepped in somewhat and interpreted the gospel. And some church doctrine is beautiful and wonderful. And again, you know, families are forever kind of a thing. And some things that are very unique to our religion that help us. I mean, my mother, for instance, that was one of the things that, you know, she lost her mother when she was very young. So that was one thing that helped her join the church. I'm a second generation LDS Mormon. So, you know, that idea that we can be together with our families after this world, that's a very unique doctrine. It's very uplifting for families to feel that way. For the most part, you know, if you've grown up in an abusive family or something, then that might be problematic. But so we have many doctrines that help us have great ideas about our lives and where we're going and where we're directed. Then we have some other things, you know, that we're not maybe quite sure of, you know, oral sex, masturbation, you know, are those things helping us or not helping us? And maybe we're still in a flux and trying to figure that stuff out. And that's why I love the whole idea of revelation, that it's ongoing. And, you know, that's something that's kind of unique to our religion as well.
Right.
Then you have culture. And if anything is going to be damaging, it's your culture. And that's when you can't step outside of the cultural box that you are in and use these ideas of the gospel and revelation and doctrine to get you to a different place.
Right. And so it's important for us to learn how to try and distinguish, although it's probably not easy because my guess is that, on the Mormon internet, we've been trying to pin down exactly what Mormon doctrine is for quite a long time now, and
Right.
it's not just like
It's
you've had,
fascinating.
yeah, just like you've been trying to figure out just something as simple as masturbation, yes or no, up or down, no pun intended.
Right.
Trying to figure out whether, how crucial it really is to bake that bread or have a garden can be hard for some people.
Yeah. Well, these men, and women who started our church were fascinating individuals, very open-minded, very much willing to step out of their box and, boy, go with all kinds of new ideas and, move their entire families and lose everything that they had, financially to kind of follow their thoughts and their philosophies and, the way that they interpreted this new religion that they were forming. So I hope that we can use them as examples for how we can also still continue to do that with all that they gave us and still continue to tweak this and make this even more perfect. And because it's a process, everything in life is a process.
Right.
And we're continually progressing, in my opinion, towards, until we walk towards back to God. I mean, that's what we're all trying to do is walking back to God. And so we're continually progressing in one way or another. And hopefully we can use those types of philosophical ideas to, help us get out of a funk or help us in a relationship that seems dire or help us with our ideas of our own sexuality and try to separate some of these things out, culture versus doctrine versus gospel versus what is our own personal relationship with our God like? I think one of the things that I've really been focusing on lately is your religion should be an anchor in your life. It should be a beacon of hope, of light. It should be what draws you, inward and help you meditate and think about your life. It should be something that helps you connect to something larger than yourself. It should not be something that's causing shame and ongoing sadness and anxiety and expectations and comparisons to other people. That's not what your religion should be about. So my new mantra is convert. And I'm not saying convert out of Mormonism. I'm just saying convert within your own religion to something more deeper and more spiritual and meaning if that's where you're at.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. That's a great philosophy and a great segue to some of the other things. And in each of these, I'm going to acknowledge up front are multi-hour topics just to scratch the surface. But I'll give my listeners a future taste of some of your insight with a few questions. Here's the first. When someone comes to you and says, "The church just isn't working for me. I'm not enjoying it. I don't like it. I don't feel the spirit. I haven't got the spiritual confirmation, or it's just too stressful, or politically, I'm just not a good fit." Have you ever seen an instance, and this is going to be tough to answer, but have you ever seen an instance where for someone to heal, leaving the church actually might have been a necessary component of their healing? Or do you? Or would you say that's never a good answer, or it's just never your place to even opine on something like that? Where would you come down on something like that? Do you think that there are some people, just like some people might be gay, and some people might have biological depression, are there some people who just aren't going to find happiness in Mormonism?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm going to ever say that one certain path is always necessary, but I have seen people who have left the church and who have led maybe healthier, happier lives. But was that necessary? I'm not sure I can say that. I think that there are many ways, many different paths to leading happier, healthier lives. That's the route they chose to go, and for them it worked, at that particular time. And maybe they did need some distance from some of these more cultural things that they've been embedded in their whole lives and have really caused some significant issues. So, I'm not comfortable saying that's the answer for anybody or not the answer for anybody. As a therapist, I'm not, that's not my role. My role is not to tell them to leave or not leave the church. They need to feel safe and comfortable. Otherwise, I'm overstepping my bounds. They need to be able to feel safe and comfortable coming to me and expressing these thoughts and ideas, and having therapy be a way we can explore the positives and the cons that can happen of any decision, whether that's leaving the church or leaving your marriage, or, but at the end of the day, it's not my position to advise people to do any of those things. People need to take responsibility for their own, actions and decisions.
Did you ever, at any point in your career, find yourself sort of rooting for them to decide one way or the other, like trying to nudge them towards staying in the church, for example, if they're starting to feel like it doesn't work for them, or keeping a marriage together if they're kind of trying to decide if they want the marriage to stay together? Like, do you ever find yourself wanting to nudge people in one direction?
I want to say no to that and feel all cool, but it's impossible. And that's something as therapists that we have to be continually aware of. And that's why we, are supervised, and that's why we go to conferences, and that's why there's all kinds of ethical, rules that we need to be aware of. And because it's impossible for me to think that my own personal experience or my own personal ideas or my own personal feelings are not going to affect my work. It's just the type. This is not a factory. This is a very personal type of work that I do, and I'm part of that equation. And I try to tell people when they come in to see me that they need to be aware of that as well. And it's another interesting statistic that I come across all the time is that the number one thing that helps people in therapy is not the modality, it's the bond with the therapist. And so you can be a behaviorist or a systemic or a, cognitive behavioral, or you can be any type of therapist, but if you cannot forge a bond, you can be highly smart and very capable, but you're not going to be able to help those people. And so I tell people very much, when they come in, if you're not comfortable here, if you don't like me, if I bug you, if my style doesn't work with you, that is okay. There's so many different personalities. You need to go find somebody else because this will be a waste of time for you. So
So
that's
you
really
recommend
important.
people shop for a therapist?
Oh, absolutely. If you're not comfortable with your therapist, get out. Absolutely.
That makes, and that terms, it's a therapeutic alliance, right? Isn't that what they call it? The relationship between the client and therapist.
And what you were talking about is called transference and counter transference. When therapists, like if somebody comes in with a situation that I recently went through or something like that, I need to be very careful to not impose my own ideas or thoughts or whatever. But yeah, there's many times that I've had to kind of check myself, especially with marriages, I think when I'm rooting for them to stay or not stay together, I have to be very, very careful about that.
That's a tough one. What do you do when somebody has the major crisis of faith where they've stumbled on the really tough church history issues, just see the church as fraudulent, and th start even thinking of it as like a cult, but maybe their spouse is in a different place, or maybe not. But have you been able to have success with somebody who's just at that point where they're beyond and never going back to the naive or the simple or the orthodox way of viewing Mormonism?
Success in what way?
Well, let's say, for one, have you ever been able to help someone work through that major crisis of faith and still feel good about active participation and membership? And is that common or uncommon for someone, once they hit that really dark place, to be able to feel good again about full, active, and happy membership?
I think where most of my work has been in this is not so much about their membership, it's about their family life. So in other words, how are they going to continue to function as a family? Because in most of these cases, the church lifestyle has been very much a part of their family life. And now, you know, one or the other spouse is, you know, changing kind of how they feel about things, and that changes the entire dance, you know, that this family has been doing, especially in the marriage. You know, how are they going to raise their kids? What are they going to tell them? So some, you know, there's all kinds of different solutions people can come up with, and people are very ingenious and very good about doing this once they're given, I think, the space to talk about it and able to lower their defenses enough to be able to have conversations about what it is that they can come up with as a family together. So there's from the person who still goes to church every week and is completely active, even though the spouse knows that they don't believe a word of it, but, you know, they feel like it's important to give their kids a culture and a tradition. And there are statistics showing that church attendance, doesn't matter what church you go to, can actually help a family be closer. And so that, you know, they choose to kind of stay with the flow because of those types of things. There are people who choose to not necessarily believe every single aspect of every little thing, but that still see great value in the basic gospel doctrine that our church offers. And so that's one way that they can be at peace with. So they're not going to get all caught up in talks about polygamy or things like that, but they're very much into the talks about, you know, the pure love of Christ or charity, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's one way people can still lead active lives. Then there's people who decide, look, I'm going to support you. You know, you're my spouse and I know you want to go with the kids. So I'll help you get the kids ready. Maybe I'll go to sacrament with you. Or maybe I'll go with you twice a month. There's families that go twice a month to church, go twice a month and go on a family hike or go drive around, do something in the nature, you know, or do something completely different, more on a different spiritual realm, right? Still spiritual, but and so that's kind of a compromise between the spouses. Then there's the spouse that just says, you know, I'm really just not able to do this at all, and I'm not going to go to church at all, and but I'm still going to respect your right to go to church. And then, you know, those are a little bit more difficult because then, you know, do the kids stay at home or do they go with the parents? So those are all things that people have to negotiate.
How about the I'm not going to go to church and I'm not going to let my kids be raised in the church, and I'd really like you to stop going to church too? Do you get that?
I have gotten that a few times, but that's usually not that's not been the majority of the case for me at all. Like when you said the cult thing, most right. of the people that I've seen get disenfranchised with the church, it's more on a historical basis, and they still see value in the church as far as kind of the basic teachings, because these are not teachings that are just, I mean, these are teachings that kind of are international. I mean, they're not just unique to ours. And I try to do a lot of work on common values. Like, what are your common values? You still share many common values with your spouse and in what you want to teach your children. You know, if you take out the church, most people still want to teach their children about education and about being kind and about, taking care of themselves and, you know, taking care of the world. I mean, there's so many different things that people can, usually when I have people do these lists, they come up with 50 things that they have in common that have nothing to do with the church, or that are lightly related to the church, or that are more humanistic in general, you know, that are just about being a good person.
Right.
Like most of us believe it's not okay to go out and kill somebody, you know?
Right.
So I do a lot of work on what is still common and have them try to not, because I think what happens so much with these couples is that they're so focused on this change that that's all that they can focus on. And so all their commonalities are going by the wayside and they're only focusing on their differences. And so I try to get that to switch around so that they can go back to
what unites them.
Right, exactly. And most people have a lot that unites them, including a big history together.
Right.
So I don't think it's appropriate for anybody to think that you're going to make a child with a person and have all the say.
Right.
That's just not realistic. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't have to do just with church doctrine. And if you think that your child, you're going to be able to protect your child from the Mormon bubble, I mean, plenty of people know about Mormons, even who aren't Mormons. It's kind of like sex. People who think they're going to be able to protect their children from knowing about sex. Doesn't matter whether you as parents talk to them about this. Somebody's going to talk to them about it.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm not a big fan of the, you know, you can't and you can't. I'm going to tell you what you can't or cannot tell my child. That has to be a mutual decision. And if not, both parents are going to pay in the end.
Right. Have you ever seen the situation where a believing spouse wants to divorce a disbelieving spouse almost purely on the grounds of their loss of faith? And that becoming like the primary impetus for the separation or divorce?
I think I have seen it be the primary, you know, reason, but I think that somehow minimizes the real issue, because I think as Mormons, we very well take pride that our religion is not just about thought. Our religion is about action. And so the Mormon family, for the most part, a large amount of their day-to-day lifestyle is based on church types of activities, from going to church on Sunday to church activities that are just for fun to family home evenings to, there's just a lot involved, you know, to your visiting, teaching, home teaching. So it's not fair to say, well, they lost their testimony and therefore I'm divorcing them and that's the only reason. It really is a change in lifestyle. So people who are divorcing because of this, it's because their whole life has changed because of this kind of what we say is a simplistic thing of losing your testimony, because it's not just changing your thought, it's changing much of the actions. And many people who decide they're no longer going to believe in the church decide to now start acting in ways that are very contrary to how the person that they married believes. You know, they'll start bringing alcohol into the home, or they'll start looking at pornography and say, there's nothing wrong with this. Or they'll start, going and spending money on Sundays, or, you know, so things that now become much more complicated than just losing your religion, or losing your faith. I mean, on an intellectual basis, it really does affect the day-to-day life. And some people don't know how to make peace with that, because it's not the life they signed up for and it's not what they wanted. And so therefore they feel like they have the right to not continue in that path with somebody.
How do you
irreconcilable differences, right? That's
yeah. Is that a tough nut to crack?
That's very difficult. It's very painful. It's very hard. And I see many couples who find compromises and do an excellent job of working through these kinds of things, and who are respectful of one another. And I see couples who aren't, you know, who aren't respectful, who don't care. I think that, you know, it's unrealistic for the spouse who leaves to think this just all of a sudden shouldn't matter to my spouse.
Right.
I mean, you marry together under a certain kind of idea of what your life was going to look like.
Yeah.
And how you were going to raise your kids. And all of a sudden you're changing all the game rules. So there has to be some, if the marriage is going to work, there has to be some type of respectful way of going about that. And the couples who do go about it that way find wonderful ways to compromise and to actually enrich in their lives. In many ways, I've seen actually things that got better for them.
Mm.
But for the couples that choose to just, well, this is my way now or the highway, well, that's not going to go so great.
Right. Well, good. Well, you're giving us some hope, and I'm looking forward to episodes dedicated just to topics like this. Well, this is, you know, I think, you and I put together a list of a lot of the things we'd want to talk about just as an overview. And I think we've covered at least 60 or 75% of them. What do you think?
Yeah, I think we've done good.
Yeah. So I guess there's two things I'd like to do other than just thank you so far for all you've shared with us. This has been really helpful and interesting. And I, for one, am very, very excited for the series.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think you're going to help a lot of people. So.
Well, thanks. I think you help a lot of people, and I'm really looking forward to being a part of this with you.
Oh, thanks, Natasha. Okay. So let's end with, two or maybe three things, and I won't ask you them all at once because then you won't have to remember questions two and three. Do you have some final ideas or philosophies you just want to share generally about, you know, what it means to be healthy with ourselves and our relationships? You talked a little bit about a concept called differentiation in some of the talking that we did before we started. So do you want to go ahead and finish up with a few thoughts in that realm? And then I'll ask you just two more questions.
Sure. Well, I think that the concept of differentiation, it's a therapist called Murray Bowen came up with that term. And it was this idea of, you know, families and individuals and all of us in our relationships are in a continuum together. And we go from being way too tightly enmeshed. That's another term. So in other words, a family who's enmeshed doesn't have a lot of leeway for doing things differently than what the family prescribes, to being disengaged, which is you can just do whatever the heck anybody wants to because nobody cares. So just,
right.
And then somewhere in the middle there is this idea of differentiation, which is kind of this term that we're all trying to become differentiated, which is different from individuated. I think our culture makes a lot of noise about being an individual and being individualized, and that's very healthy. Well, it's not completely healthy because an individual is an island, and we don't want to be islands. We want to be in relationships, whether that's with our families or our spouses or our kids or whoever. So this idea of differentiation is we can be very connected with our loved ones and have great relationships and love each other and serve one another and you know, do the day-to-day stuff that we all do together, and at the same time still be an individual so that I don't have to get lost in that process, that I don't have to completely sacrifice myself in the process of helping somebody else or being part of some of this other system.
Right.
And the metaphor I love to use is, you know, if you've ever traveled on an airplane, which I have with kids many times.
Yeah.
They'll say, okay, so and when you're traveling with kids, you're a little bit more nervous. I'm paying more attention to what these ladies are telling me or the men that, oh my gosh, I'm not even remembering the word, but the people who work, the stewardesses.
Flight attendants.
Yes, the flight attendants. Thank you. They'll say, you know, if we have problems, the little gas masks will come down and you are not to put them on your children first. You are to put them on yourself. And that's always, you know, it's hard as a mom because the first reaction is to save your kid. But I can't save my kid if I'm unconscious. And so I have to put it on first. I have to put on my own mask first. And that's the metaphor I like to give about differentiation, that we serve ourselves and we help ourselves because we want to help and serve others. And then that's a very nice mixture of not being too selfish and not being selfish enough. Does that
right.
make sense?
Sure. Sure. And that's something I hate to admit it, that Oprah taught me. You really, if you're not well, you really can't do a good job of helping others be well.
That's right.
And you can't always be well on an island. You kind of need others to help you.
That's pretty lonely on an island. Yeah.
Yeah. So you kind of have to strike that balance, don't you?
And it's the best, you know, I think most of us want to be, for those of us who are parents, we want to teach our kids and give them the best we can. And unless we're teach them the main way is by example. And so if you're overly anxious or overly depressed or overly whatever because of your situation, then that's what you're teaching them. And, you know, if you have an awful marriage, then that's what you're teaching them. So those are the incentives for taking care of ourselves. So it's always very interesting how life is just very connected. Everything has its opposite. You know, this idea of, oh, we need to serve others, but really we can't serve others without serving ourselves. There's always that push and pull in any type of philosophy or doctrinal type of belief system.
Right. Striking that balance.
That's right.
Well, why don't we end with you sharing with the listeners maybe a bit of a vision of what you'd like to do with your series. maybe some just super high level goals and maybe some topics that you really hope to try and cover. And then maybe you can add an invitation for our listeners if they have stories or experiences that really fit well into some of those categories to either write you directly or to write me at Mormon Stories, and to volunteer to come on the show and to tell their story.
Okay. I think my goal is similar to yours in that, I believe so much in communication and education. And when we are willing to speak out and share our stories or our ideas or thoughts, we automatically become an asset to other people. And along with that, so I guess my thought is both from lay people and also professional people is I would like to interview not only people who are maybe going through issues themselves, but maybe other, therapists or researchers or there's a lot of great LDS members who are studying psychology or issues related to that and doing great dissertations or papers or whatever on topics such as we've been discussing. I'm interested in listening to people who, I guess my vision is not so much to have people come on and ask a question, and get the help. I think my vision more is for those who have gotten the help in whatever means, whether it's more naturalistic or through medicine or through therapy, or maybe a combination of all of those things, to then come on and share, hey, this is what we went through, this is what I went through, this is how I'm dealing with it, this is what I found helpful. I would hope that no issue is taboo. That's something that's very important on my blog. I'm tired of taboo. I don't want I want the, anything to be on the table. Because when things become taboo, they become usually dysfunctional. So I'd rather talk about things, even if they're difficult topics, even if they're topics that might offend or might seem offensive. I would hope that we could all be mature enough in this type of venue to discuss this idea of of humanity, how we all fall short, we all are redeemable, and we all have great ingenuity to succeed and progress. That's really the drive that's within us all. So I would hope if we look at topics in that way that it wouldn't matter what the topic would be.
That's wonderful. That sounds like a good vision of something I'm eager to follow.
Good. Well, I'm excited and
Are there some specific topics you want to throw out there for our listeners to write us in and maybe even volunteer to share their stories?
well, I think any of the topics we covered today, are obviously great, and from sexuality to depression to the Mormon lifestyle and how that has affected people, both pro and con. And but I think too, what's difficult when asked that type of a question is that I don't want anybody out there listening going, "Well, they didn't mention my issue, so I won't call in." Because sometimes some of the best stories are things that I've never even thought of or heard of before, and those can be very intriguing and wonderful stories. And or the other issue that happens as well, everybody's going to call in about depression, so my story doesn't matter. But everybody's story is different, and so even though we have generic things that can be helpful to everybody, it can always be useful to hear somebody's unique take on something as common as depression, for instance.
And I'm going to completely validate that sentiment that we want a wide and a broad range of topics and stories to be shared and discussed. And having acknowledged that, I want to go ahead and list some.
Okay.
So, I mean, we're talking eating disorders, we're talking anxiety disorders, OCD, we're talking trichotillomania, we're talking addictions, abuse, marital problems, sexual problems, sexuality, homosexuality, schizophrenia, dealing with the loved one, Alzheimer's, any of that kind of stuff, relationships, spiritual or faith crises, anything else that just comes to mind to violate the sentiment that you just previously expressed. I want to just make sure that people know the breadth and the depth of what we're trying to cover. Did we get most of them?
Yeah, and it can go on. So,
okay.
And some of those things people may not even know what they are. So that's exciting too, to explain what some of these things look. So yeah.
Beautiful. All right. Well, Natasha Parker, I just want to thank you so much. Again, the website is mormontherapist.blogspot.com. Is that right?
Yes.
And I hope to work with you to get your own website up soon. Is that something
yes.
we might do together? Okay.
Yes, because I'm technologically deficient.
Yeah. So we'll be working on a mormontherapist.com coming your way soon, hopefully.
Yes.
And you can – what email address can people write you at?
That would be natasha.parker at sbcglobal.net.
Okay. And I imagine your website has your email address as well?
Yeah, the blog does.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And everyone's also welcome to email me at mormonstories@gmail.com, and I can always pass things on to Natasha. And for now, we're going to post these podcasts on the Mormon Stories website and in the Mormon Stories podcast feed. And over time, we'll see whether this ends up migrating to its own, either its own podcast or maybe a shared podcast where it's co-produced or something to that effect. But regardless, Natasha Parker, thank you so much for giving us a taste of the goodness that is in store for us with your new endeavor.
Oh, thank you, John. That's very kind.
All right. Talk to you very soon.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, Skye, Pixton.com. Thank you.